All right, well, according to my watch, it's time that we begin this session. So I want to thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure of mine to be here at Holden and with all you people. And an additional blessing that I've been able to tell you a little bit about an area that I do research in, and that is animal science. So, I am Andrew Richter. I'm a professor of physics at Valparaiso University. Any Valpo alum here? All right, a couple, all right. I think we're overwhelmed by Luther alums. this is my first visit here to Holden with my wife and son. And so far, we're enjoying it a lot. We've been here a week, and we'll be here for another week. So. And if you run into me outside and you have questions about science or animal that I didn't get to, please feel free to ask me anytime. And also during this session, if you want a further clarification or have a question you'd like answered, I'll do my best and feel free to ask at any time. So I'm going to talk to you about nano stuff. And it's a term that gets tossed around a lot, but not everybody knows what the nano in nanoscience means. And so let me give you a really brief introduction to, introduction to the metric system. Because nano here is reference to nanometers. So how many of you really know the metric system? Anybody? A few people who work in technology areas.
Define really
know. Yeah, that's a good
It's based on
divisions of 10, really. So on decades, and so good. And the nano is a prefix for different metric scales or metric dimensions. So the one that we're referencing here is a meter, which is exactly that long. So that's 1 meter. It's about 3 feet, or about a yard. I'm 1.8 meters tall. And then, in metric system, we divide by 10, and that's exactly 10. So, 1 decimeter, which we don't really use very much. But if we divide by 10 again, we get to something that we use a lot of, or we use a lot, and that's a centimeter. 100 centimeters is a meter. And we'll divide one more time by 10, and I can barely put that on there, and I get 1 millimeter. So 1,000 millimeters goes into a meter, so 1/1,000th of a meter. And this is all called the macro scale. It's the size of things that we can see with our eye, unaided eye. Okay. Now there's no reason to stop there. We can keep on dividing by 10 as long as we'd like. So if we take the millimeter and divide by 10, I can't really draw that. I don't have a fine enough tip. So I'll have to have you imagine that I'm going to do exactly the same thing that I just did with a meter, but I'm going to start with a millimeter. So I'm going to divide by 10, divide by 10 again, and divide by 10 yet one more time. So another division by 1,000, and you end up with a micron, which is 1/1,000,000th of a meter. And this is the micro scale, so where microscopes are the reign. Okay. So, and this is a script mu, or it's a mu, it's a Greek mu, because m is taken for milli. So, now again, I don't have to stop there. I can divide a micron by 10, and 10 again, and 10 yet again. So I'm going to divide by another 1,000. Now I'm at the nanometer. Truly small. Truly small unit. It's a billionth of a meter. You take a billion nanometers and stick them all end to end and you get a meter. Really kind of hard to imagine. I mean, I can't even imagine a billion. We toss around some numbers here, but it's really a number that you can't imagine. you see a billion of things a lot. A billion grains of sand doesn't take up much room. But to visualize something like $1 billion is a really difficult thing to do. So, in order to try to make this a little more concrete, because these are really absurd numbers, I'm going to take you on an excursion down to the nanoscale. And hopefully, my hope is that by starting big and ending small, we'll step down there together, okay, and we'll maybe get a better feel for what's going on, or what the scale of this phenomenon is. And so we're going to take a trip to the nanoscale, and this is based on this idea of how many angels would fit in a pin. So I've got a head of a pin here, and it's taken by a regular camera with a nice macro lens, and the head of a pin is about 2 millimeters across. I should mention that I'm secondarily borrowing from a writer named Natalie Angier, who's a science writer from the New York Times. And she's written a book called The Canon, which is an overview of sciences. And it's a really good read. She's a great wordsmith, so I recommend that book to you.
What's the name of it?
The Canon.
C-A-N-N-O-N?
C-A-N-O-N. And it's Natalie Angier. How many increasingly small objects would fit on the head of a pin? Here I've got an aphid next to the head of a pin, so about one aphid. So we can see aphids. Gardeners see them all the time. Not too many of them. So you can see that size. And about one fits on the head of a pin. We'll go a little smaller, and we'll look at the size of a human hair. So again, you can take a picture of this with a camera with a good lens, but you get a better picture if you use a microscope. And we see that the hair, the human hair, is about 0.1 millimeters across, or about 100 microns. Okay. And if you're tenacious enough, you could drape 20 human hairs across the head of a pin. Why you'd want to do that, I don't know. You could, if you want. But that actually sort of sets the scale. This human hair sort of sets the scale for the limit of resolution of the unaided eye. 50 microns, about half the width of the human hair, is the smallest objects that you can see, or smallest features that you can see. It's the limit of resolution for a human eye. Okay, so we'll go further, and now we're getting into the microscopic range, and we get to things like pollen grains, which you can't see individual pollen grains. You can certainly see a film of these on your car in the spring day. But you're seeing trillions of these. So in fact, this kind of pollen grain, they come in all sizes and shapes, is about 20 microns across. And about 8,000 of those fit on the head of a pin. So we're starting to get big numbers all of a sudden. Okay? We're getting smaller, and then how many fit on the head of a pin is going to get absurdly large. But hopefully, again, by going there, we'll see how this works. Next step down, about the same length, size scale, is the size of the cells in your body. White blood cell, about 12 microns across. You've got some red blood cells there. About 20,000 of these would fit on the head of the pin. Okay. Smaller yet are bacteria. Here's the ubiquitous E. coli bacteria. About 10 million of these would fit on the head of a pin, and they produce so rapidly that would quickly occur, which is why we use that Germex stuff when we go to the dining hall. So they're only about 2 microns long and about half a micron wide. And this actually is about the limit of the optical microscope, about 0.3 microns. So actually, this picture isn't taken with an optical microscope. You could see them with an optical microscope, but you couldn't really see many features of them. This is taken by something called an electron microscope. And this is a good time as any to mention that I'm going to be giving 2 nanoscience lectures. Today, I'll do an overview of what nano is, and then talk about what makes it special, and then give some demonstrations. And then tomorrow, I'll reintroduce this for anybody who's not seen this. Say how we see things on the nanoscale. And then give some examples of cutting-edge research that's being done and applications of this nanoscience is being tailored or experimented for. Okay, so I invite you to join me tomorrow as well. Okay, we go a little smaller, and we get to viruses, smaller than bacteria. This is the HIV virus. Again, we can't see on this scale. So this is another kind of electron microscope picture. And we have to interpret what this is as a picture. So an artist has made this nice, pretty picture from this somehow. And I don't know how to get that, but they get it. So an HIV virus is about 0.1 microns across, or 100 nanometers. This is our first nanoparticle. We're now in the nano regime. Okay? And about 30 million HIV particles could fit on the head of a pin. Okay, even smaller virus, rhinovirus, the common cold. About 30 nanometers across, about 3 billion of these could fit on the head of a pin. Okay? So, again, we're getting to some crazy numbers here. By the way, I couldn't resist putting this on here when I was researching this. I saw you can buy a stuffed animal, a stuffed virus. My son, who's five, really, really wants.
Oh.
In fact, he wants the whole set.
Shigella and
Strucker
virus.
They're very popular. They're very cute, I think.
Syphilis is actually quite cute.
Syphilis?
Syphilis is quite cute. The little stuffed toy syphilis was quite cute, and I almost bought it for a colleague of mine. I'm a science teacher, and then I decided probably not good that I gave her syphilis.
All right, so we're going to go a couple more steps down. The next step down is protein, level of proteins. And these are nature's nanomachines. At any given time, about 100 million of these are operating in your cell, in each cell in your body. This particular one is hemoglobin, which is responsible for ferrying oxygen around in your body by rusting and de-rusting iron that sits in the middle, or in this picture, this. And again, since we can't see on the nanoscale, we have to make pictures, representations of what it looks like. Here's a picture of most of the atoms in this protein. Here's a different kind of picture highlighting the structure, the way these atoms are stuck together. And about 300 billion of these would fit on the head of it. The last step we'll take in is to look at an individual atom, so one of the oxygen atoms, about 0.3 nanometers across. This is actually now in the atomic regime. We're out of the nanometer regime here, the nanoscale. But about 30 trillion under the nano pin. So again, truly outrageous numbers, but hopefully by taking this excursion, you can get some idea of just how small it is, the material we're talking about. We could keep on going, and if we went another five orders of magnitude down, we'd get to the regime of particle physics. And so you can keep on going down. Apparently, there's a limit. The limit, as far as physics is concerned, as far as we can tell, is if you take one meter and divide it by 10 43 times. And that seems to set the smallest length scale that can exist. So, called the Planck length. We're not going anywhere near there. So we're going to stay in the nano regime. Okay. Any questions so far? Yeah.
The double helix?
Yes.
What was one pair of those be in a nanoscale?
DNA, I believe, is on the order of, I can't remember if it's 2 nanometers across or something.
Okay, that range.
Something like that, yeah. An atomic bond is about a tenth of a nanometer, two-tenths of a nanometer. Okay, any other questions? Again, feel free to interrupt me as we go. So, the next question is, what's the hype about? What's all the hubbub about nano? Because it's all over the place in the media. What makes it so special? Is it just that if we take a big chunk of, say, gold and break it up into little tiny, smaller chunks of gold, are we just using less gold? Is it? What is the deal? I mean, if it's just a matter of taking one form and converting it into another form, big deal. That's not that exciting. So there's got to be something more. And the more is that as you get smaller and smaller, new features of the same old stuff emerge. And that's what makes it so exciting. Because we can take the same stuff that we know a lot about from centuries of experimentation and find new uses for the same material. Okay. So now there are a lot of different ways that this occurs. And I'm only going to show you a few of these, or talk about a few of these. And one of the main ones is quantum effects. Some of you might have heard of quantum mechanics. The classical mechanics is what we're used to, are the rules that govern macroscopic objects, how baseballs fly through the air, how planets go around the sun. That's classical mechanics that was worked out in the 17th, 18th, 19th century, actually 18th, 19th centuries. And it turned out when people were looking at subatomic or nanoscale materials, it no longer applied. And so a new set of rules was invented called quantum mechanics that governs how subatomic and nanoscale materials work. This was started by a guy named Planck and then forwarded by Einstein and people named Bohr and Heisenberg and various luminaries of the previous turn of the century, last century. So, and quantum mechanics is very weird. Some person has said, I forget who it is, maybe one of you know, that if anybody who claims that they understand quantum mechanics has no idea what they're talking about. We can understand it on a mathematical framework, in a mathematical way. But it makes no sense to us. It's against our common sense in many cases. And one of the ways that it's against our common sense is this. And this is kind of a big thing. Localization produces quantized energies. What does that mean? If you take something and confine it to a region, all of a sudden, according to quantum mechanics, it can no longer have whatever energy it wants, but only discrete values of energy. To try to make this a little more concrete, you might imagine that something that's moving really slow has low energy, and something that's moving really fast has high energy. So I'm going to use speed as a stand-in for energy. And so what this is suggesting is that if you say, put me in a room, like this one, and all of a sudden I can no longer go whatever speed I want, but I can only go 1 meter per second, or 2 meters per second, or 3 meters per second, and it depends on how big the room is, how confined I am, how localized I am. Now, of course, that makes no sense to us. You can't imagine driving your car around and only being able to go 10 miles per hour, 20 miles per hour, and nothing in between. If you accelerate in quantum mechanics, you start from one speed and jump to the next speed, a quantum leap. So if I take an electron, which is a subatomic particle that carries electric charge, responsible for electricity, and stick it into a small nanoparticle, something that's tiny, it can no longer have whatever energy or speed that it wants bouncing around inside there, but actually has to have only a discrete set of energies. The reason for this is that according to quantum mechanics, particles are not just particles, but also waves. We think of a baseball as being like a particle. It's here. And a water wave as being extended over a large region. But according to quantum mechanics, every particle also behaves like a wave. It depends, actually, to some extent, on what we want to see. Okay? If I set up an experiment to see an electron as a particle, that's what I see. If I want to set up an experiment to see it as a wave, that's what I see. My students do this all the time in sophomore level lab at school. So now you can imagine that if you have a wave and you localize it, only certain patterns can arise in that wave. It's like the notes of a musical instrument. These are called standing waves. And so there's only the fundamental, and then the first harmonic, and then the second harmonic. And you change the pitch, or the wavelength of that, by changing which pipe you're sending air through, or which string, where your finger is on the fretboard, or different mechanisms. Same idea. Except we're talking about an electron behaving like a wave. Okay, so if I put an electron in here, it can have this energy, or this energy, or this energy, or this energy, or I've only drawn a few of the possible energy. If I localize it less, put it in a bigger nanoparticle, these energy levels still there, but they're getting closer together. Okay? And make it even bigger, they're still there, it's still discrete, still quantized energy levels, but they're getting closer together. In fact, if I go to the macroscopic, and stick an electron in a chunk of gold, the energy levels are so close together that we might as well say that they're continuous. Okay? And that gets back to what we commonly think about. And in quantum mechanics, you always have to end up, if you get big enough so that it's macroscopic, it has to end up being what we experience. So, in fact, quantum mechanics says if I'm walking around this room, if I'm pacing around this room, I'm not pacing at whatever speed I want, but in these discrete energies. But no instrument that we could possibly even imagine constructing would be able to actually tell me, because I'm a macroscopic object, moving in a macroscopic room. Okay. So how does this get used? Well, if I put this electron in here and it's at low energy, going slow, and somehow I excite it, I give it more energy, it will make a quantum leap up to another energy level, and then, I guess because nature is slothful, I don't know how to describe this, why this is the case, but everything likes to achieve its lowest energy state, right? Which is why we're all here. So this excited electron would like to get back, and when it does, in some cases, it can give off light. The energy that it had up here has to go somewhere, and it gets sent off as a beam of light, actually a photon of light, particle of light. And the color of that light depends on the energy difference, here, how much energy it's giving up. So if they're closer together, it's not giving off much light. Okay. And you may not have known this, but low energy light, visible light, is red. As you go towards violet, it gets higher and higher energy. Okay. All right. So, another kind of quantum effect that shows up on the nanoscale, not on the macro scale, is called tunneling. You may have heard of this. Some people some books like to describe it this way. If I lean against this wall for long enough, I may eventually pass through it. I may tunnel through it. Classically, that doesn't happen. Okay? Quantum mechanically, it's possible. Although the probability is exponentially small because I'm a macroscopic object. Right? Essentially, it's like winning the lottery a trillion times in a row or something like that. It's extremely small. Likewise, if I throw a baseball at that wall, classically, it's not going to go through unless I throw it really hard, of course. But quantum mechanically, there's a small possibility that it would just pop right through that wall. Tunnel through the wall. Of course, because it's a macroscopic object, that probability is extremely small. But if you're talking about an electron, or a particle that's in the nucleus of an atom, then it happens all the time. In fact, that's what causes some forms of radioactive decay. It's parts of the nucleus popping out, tunneling out where it shouldn't happen. And this can happen, so this can be something that you can employ when you're talking about nanoscale materials. They can tunnel through, or they can have electrons contained in them that can tunnel out.
Good question. Is this sort of like acupuncture in the sense it goes into your skin because there's room somehow for this very little thing to go in? Or is it because things move out of the way, or?
Yeah, no, actually, yeah, that's a good question. How do we visualize this? And I'm going to try to do that for you here.
Okay.
It may not help. not because of any deficiency in your part, but because it's kind of weird.
Okay.
So, it arises because of this wave nature of matter. Okay, so what I'm going to show you is an electron visualized as a wave going through a barrier. Okay, let me pause it for a second. That's not this barrier, this wall. Okay, so imagine this is like a wall for a baseball. It's going to hit this barrier, and classically, it would just bounce right off. But because this electron, here's an electron, described as a wave, okay, it's a localized wave in some sense, doesn't exist everywhere to a large degree, but because it's a wave, it can actually feel its way through this barrier. So I'll show you how that looks. All right. Here's this electron. It hits the barrier, and some of it just goes right on through. And actually, it's down here. This height of this hump tells you the probability of finding the particle there. So quantum mechanically, there's some possibility of finding the electron on the other side of the wall. Whereas classically, forget about it. It's not going to happen. So So, because of the wave nature of subatomic particles, you can have this weird behavior happening.
So it's like a worm going through the soil.
Yeah. I guess that would be a fine way to put it. But because the materials are all made of waves as well, and waves can stack upon waves pretty easily, you don't really have to make room for it. It just goes on through, like one water wave passing through another. Okay. Again, if you don't understand this, that's good, right? Because if you understand quantum mechanics, then you're not really understanding it.
This is a place of faith.
It's a faith issue.
All right. So, there are other kinds of quantum phenomena that show up. One is called entanglement. That I'm not going to talk about, except for to say that some people have shown that you can sort of teleport an object from one place to another in a weird, very not as satisfying as as Star Trek type
of
thing.
Oh, darn.
But yeah, I know. It would make getting up here a lot easier, right? So, and the other one is superposition. And this is the basis for quantum computing. That an atom or a molecule can exist simultaneously in a multitude of different states. And it's not until we look at it that it chooses one. So I'm happy to talk to you about that.
What did you call that again?
Superposition. Yeah, it's if you've heard of Schrodinger's cat, this experiment of having a cat inside of a box, and it could be either alive or dead. And you don't know until you open it up. That cat, quantum mechanically, if that cat were a subatomic particle or a molecule, would be both alive and dead at the same time. So until you make the observation. It's one of the weirdnesses of quantum mechanics. And like I said, it would be used in quantum computers. Okay. Another area that nano is important for is an idea of surface area. And it turns out that a lot of the really useful phenomena occur at surfaces. Just a few examples is the catalytic converter in your exhaust system. Right? It has a thin layer of platinum, not a nano thin layer, but a thin layer of platinum. And as the exhaust gases flow over that platinum, they're converted into less noxious forms of pollution. And so you can reduce your emissions. This happens at a surface. It doesn't happen inside a big chunk of platinum, but at the surface. Similarly, titanium dioxide breaks down pollutants, and Singapore is toying with the idea of painting their sidewalks with titanium dioxide to get rid of smog. to help get rid of smog. So. Hydrogen economy requires hydrogen storage. How do you store flammable gas in your car if you want to have a fuel cell? And people are thinking that it will the best way to do this is to adsorb hydrogen onto a very porous material, because hydrogen likes to go onto a surface. And then you can heat up the material a little bit and it'll pop off. So what do I mean by surface? It's where one thing can come into contact with another. And nano allows you to increase that surface area dramatically. So as an analogy, think of a jar of coins. Now, I couldn't find a good picture of this. I was imagining, you know, one of those wine carboys that my parents used to have. They'd throw their change in. I don't know what happened to the wine. There's like 30 gallons of wine they never told me. But they throw their change into the wine jar, and of course, most of those coins are buried deep inside, okay? And only a few of those are accessible, actually, on the outside, in contact with the glass. But if you take a smaller container, say a roll, okay, just the same size, practically, as the object you're trying to put into a container, then every single one of those coins is in contact with the boundary, is at the boundary. Okay? It's accessible in some ways. So you can have the same amount of coins, but just wrapped up in smaller chunks. Okay? And now, instead of having the coins inaccessible, they're accessible to you. So, I'll demonstrate this in a second. Oh, I forgot to bring something from the library. I may have to have you send you out. Can you bring a couple books from the children's section about, thank you. The 1 gram is about the weight of a bill. Okay, so we're not used to thinking of grams. Again, it's one of those metric things. So very light. Okay, so a dollar bill or a $20 bill weighs 1 gram and has a surface area of only 30 square inches, roughly, 200 square centimeters. Okay, so front and back. A material that I work with, a nanomaterial I work with, 1 gram of that material has a surface area of 30 million square centimeters, about the size of a football field.
Wow.
So you can dramatically increase the area for contact with stuff, with materials. Okay. and this isn't even the record holder I read about a few weeks ago. They've gotten it up to 50 million square centimeters. And this is a material, again, that will be used for hydrogen storage, probably. Okay. Another reason nano is exciting is that it's biorelevant. Nature's nanomachines that it's had a long time to develop are proteins and DNA and things like that. These all carry out life's functions on a nano scale. They're truly nano machines. Well, if we make our own analogs, which are called biomimetics, artificial constructs on that same scale can do much of the same stuff. They can get in where they need to get. They can get into the cells. They can get into the nucleus of the cell. They can catalyze different biological processes. Now, again, science is a lot about stealing from nature, what nature has already done, and just tweaking it to do what we want it to do instead of what it's meant to do or has evolved to do. So we take that at the nano scale really seriously because this is where all the fun stuff for biology is occurring. So if we make stuff on the same scale, then you can use it for medicine and biological exploration. Another reason is that these materials can be electronically fast. Completely different type of application. If you, in your cell phone or in your computer, information has to get from point A to point B, and it's sent via electrons. And they're really fast, but they're not infinitely fast. So if you can cut down the size between, say, your processor and your memory or something, you can dramatically increase the speed and end up with faster computers. Okay. So that can happen if you design everything on the nanoscale. Also, a lot of nanomaterials behave like superconductors in some fashion, in some fashions. Superconductors, as you may know, are conductors that don't waste the energy of the electricity that's flowing through them. Most conductors heat up, as anybody who's used a laptop or a cell phone for a long time knows. Okay, so superconductors don't get hot, right? Nanoconductors, nanomaterials, that's a lot of these won't get very hot at all for a variety of reasons. So I'll talk about one of these tomorrow. Okay. Similar area of technology is, say, memory storage. Computer memory takes some physical space. If you want to store information, it has to be contained in some space. And if you can shrink that to the size of a molecule or a nanoparticle, then you can pack much more into the same space. And instead of having an 8-gigabyte iPhone, you could have an 8,000-gigabyte iPhone, or whatever. Now, I don't know if you want that much space. I don't know what you're going to do with that much space. But it's worth noting that even 20 years ago, people were saying, what are you going to do with more than 10 megabytes? And we've certainly gone beyond that. So, and lastly, in this area that I'll talk about, comes back to what I said, is not that exciting, but it is true. Take that platinum in your catalytic converter. If you had to use a chunk of platinum, that would be really expensive. Platinum is one of the most expensive materials. And it's very rare. So, in fact, it's for a lot of things, like hydrogen fuel cells use platinum right now. And it's going to be a limiting problem. Is there enough platinum on the planet accessible to make the fuel cells that we want to replace internal combustion engines? So, but if you can have a nanoscale material, very little of that material, to do exactly the same thing, why not do it? Right? Saves material, and it's much more efficient. And oftentimes that's the case for certain kinds of processes. Okay. Any questions? Yeah.
Other than properties of light, what does nano teach us about space?
About outer space?
Outer space.
Yeah. That's a good question. I haven't seen anybody really put these together. It is if you go even deeper to smaller and smaller length scales, down to that Planck scale that I told you about earlier, there you have to worry about how the small and the big fit together in things like black holes and things like that. And it is the hot area of research, because right now gravity, the theory of gravity that tells us how the universe moves around, and quantum mechanics, which tells us how tiny things work, don't work together. And so this is the problem of unification. A theory of everything. So how do you put it all together? And no one really knows yet. Some ideas are string theory, and you may have heard of that. And Brian Greene, popular writer, talks about that. Another writer that I like has a different approach, named Lee Smolin. And he's written a book called Five Roads to Quantum Gravity. So sounds pretty heavy, but it's actually a pretty accessible text, I think. So, yeah.
Did anyone finish Einstein's unified field theory?
No. He worked on that a long time and never really made that much headway. And a lot of people wish he hadn't worked on it so long, because he seemed to have wasted most of his life getting nowhere. And that's not for lack of trying or intelligence, obviously, but it's a hard problem, and there's a lot of people working on it. Like I said, string theory is one area. I personally don't like string theory. It's too metaphysical for me. It's hard to test whether or not string theory is an answer. Yeah.
How did you get interested in
this area? That's a good question. It was a variety of accidents. I just had a professor at Marquette University who turned me on to materials that weren't crystal, weren't really regular materials. This messy area. My advisor at Northwestern, where I did my PhD work, called this area sludge physics because it's organic and often deals with like proteins and organic materials that don't crystallize into nice crystals and fancy things, but are sludgy. So the compost pile probably produces a lot of the kinds of materials that I actually study. And I liked that messiness. When I give popular talks, I say what I do is I use X-rays to study these materials. And so what I like to say is I use things that are invisible, X-rays, to study things that are invisible. Mm-hmm. And that way I can do whatever I want. So not quite, but there are people checking on me, which is good. So so it's just curiosity about stuff that hadn't really been studied a ton. Mm-hmm. And it's all interdisciplinary at this point. I work with chemists and biologists and biomedical engineers and material scientists. And so it's fun getting to know all this stuff. It's a little scary, too.
What's the thrust of your research? Practical biomedical?
I have a couple of different projects. One of them is a biomedical related. I'll talk about it tomorrow, actually. Or if you can't make it tomorrow, I'm happy to talk to you.
I'll be here tomorrow.
Okay. And then other stuff to deal with how we understand proteins, structure of proteins. Okay. Yes.
So you said you also work with biologists.
Yeah.
Do you also work with theologians and philosophers?
No. No, I am a scientist who's a Christian. You have to be careful not to say Christian scientist. scientist who's a Christian. And I feel it's really important to keep these spheres separate. I was talking to you about last week. The religious and the scientific are both are both human endeavors, okay? And so they interact within scientists and lay people who are interested in both realms, and both are really important, right? And so I don't mean to say one is here and one is here, but I think for me it's very important to keep them separate so they don't damage each other. Okay, so I try to keep these things separate.
Do you ever see where there's an interaction between the two, or the two are actually connected?
Do you see
that as a scientist?
I don't in my research. Of course, once you extrapolate, you get to these regimes like string theory, or what happened before the Big Bang, and these kinds of questions. And I'm a firm believer in saying that you apply physics and science broadly and well, but not beyond where it's supposed to be applied. Okay? And so some of these realms get to there, so I think you need to be careful. Some people are not being very careful. So, yeah.
Well, it sort of leads to the question that I had was not phrased the same way, but was really around what might be kind of the ethical conversation. So when
that's
you
a good question.
Apply well, what does that mean?
That's a really good question, yeah. Because much of my work is done really on a fundamental level, well before it gets to any kind of application, I haven't really been dealing with ethicists about this, although I will mention some of this next session. Nanomaterials, have a lot of promise to change a lot of things, but we have to be really careful about how we employ them so that we don't repeat things like asbestos remediation, right? Or PCBs in our water systems, or, you know, all these different things that we're stuck with because people weren't very careful. I'm going to be giving a session on a book by Bill Bryson, talking about the theory of, or brief history of nearly everything.
Yeah.
And and he gives this great story about this chemist who worked for DuPont, I believe, who apparently had no kind of scruples at all about this kind of stuff. He's the person who put lead into gasoline and gave us CFCs. So, you know, anyway, there are people, National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health, Department of Energy, Department of Education, all the major federal funding agencies are aware and are actively funding research into the safety of nanoparticles and nanomaterials and nanoscience. Whether or not it's at the level that it should be is another question. And so that's the kind of stuff that I read about on a policy level, but I don't really interact on a daily basis or weekly basis with personally. Yes?
Some of that's because you're doing characterization work.
Yes.
At the physics level, sometimes he gets irritated when people ask him the application for his work, because at the physics level, it's so much before that. I mean, there are physicists who work for companies who do that. He's just trying to characterize how these things work. And so it's several steps later when then you figure out what to do with them and then what all that might mean.
Yeah, that's
so,
right.
So
yeah.
Your own work is several steps below.
Yes.
When those issues come
in. Yes, definitely. Yeah. Thanks. Okay. we have a few minutes here. I want to do a few demos, and it might surprise you that there are things that you can demonstrate on the nano scale. I mean, that's tiny. How do you see things? Well, I've got two that I can demonstrate, actually physically demonstrate. And then one that will be an analogy that hopefully will cement some of the concepts that we just talked about, what makes nano special. And I have in my hand here some of these, some what are called quantum dots. And this is like what I was talking about when you confine an electron only achieve certain energies, or can only have certain energies. Well, here I have what are called cadmium selenide nanoparticles, all in the same concentration. Okay, the only difference between these different vials is the size of the particle. And as you remember, if you have a large particle, then the energy levels are closely spaced, and you get low energy light coming out, red. And if you have smaller particles, then the energy levels are wider space, and you get green or blue coming out. So this cost me about $100. It's really actually, that's just because they could charge 10 times overhead pretty much on it. The materials themselves are simple to make. We could, if I had brought up a jar of this and a bottle of that, we could go to the kitchen and make it. I don't think that Paul would be very happy about that. A few noxious things are created, but my students, I'm trying to implement this in my sophomore level lab class because it's something they can do in maybe an hour. So all you do is you take chemical A and chemical B, some cadmium something and selenium something, and you stick it in to a beaker, and you heat it up. And you stir it around, and then you start taking little bits out, because these nanoparticles grow. So you take them out before they get to a certain size, and you cool them off, and you got a small nanoparticle, and that's...
Are they crystalline?
They actually are crystalline. So, and here are green nanoparticles. Okay? Nice green. I'm exciting the electrons by using UV light. This is a little... The company that sold me this wanted to charge me a lot of money for something like this. I found it, it's one of these things that you look around for pet urine.
And it works.
It works, yes. yes, it works. So if I go a little bigger, then I get yellow. Go a little bigger, orange, and a little bigger, red. Okay. So these are nanoparticles. I'll let you guys play around with them if you want. And they're really accessible. And actually, one application for these, besides making pretty lights, is you can actually, because they're so small, you can attach them to different molecules, different components of the cell, and watch them with a microscope move around. So that's what they're mainly used for right now.
Question?
Yes.
How do you attach them to the cell?
That's a good question. You can decorate the outside.
Scotch tape.
Of them. Yeah. Metal tape. Yeah. You can attach a molecule to them pretty easily using standard chemistry, and the other end of the molecule likes to attach to a particular kind of molecule. It's called decorating a nanoparticle. So, and it's straightforward chemistry. Not difficult. In fact, these are already decorated nanoparticles so that they will be suspended in liquid. Otherwise, they would just sediment out. Okay. Another one, while you're looking at that, I will try to put this together here. Another area is surface. Another thing that nano is good at, remember, is dramatically increasing surface area. So, if I take two books, okay, so this is the analogy one. These aren't nano books. I'm not if I take two books and I put one on top of each other and I tilt it a little bit, they stay in place, right? Because of friction. And now friction turns out to be weakly related to surface area of contact. So there's not much contact area, so if I just tilt a little bit, they separate. So, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to break these up into nanoparticles by interleaving the pages, okay? So I'm going to take the same book, same mass, but dramatically increase the amount of surface area of contact, and we'll see what happens. Now, has anybody watched Mythbusters?
Oh, yeah.
So you may have seen this before. In Mythbusters, they took the myth, the parent myth, that if you took two phone books and interleaved all the pages that you couldn't separate them. Now, I don't know, I've never tried a full phone book. That seems like a whole lot of work to do. I don't know who they had do it. Probably if it were in academics, we'd make grad students do it. I suppose they had plenty of interns who were had to do it. So they interleaved a couple of phone books. I'm not going to do that many pages, but I should warn you that there's a saying in the sciences about demonstrations that if it moves, it's biology. If it smells bad, it's chemistry. And if it doesn't work, it's physics. So we'll see if this works. It's worked in the past, so. But as we know, in science, says even though something worked in the past doesn't necessarily mean it'll work in the future. Okay, so I'm increasing the surface area of contact, and the hope is that this will become so strongly glued together in some way that not just a small tilt, but I can basically hold these things together just by friction. And those of you who watched the episode on Mythbusters know that it worked. Okay. That they tried pulling it apart, could not do it. Two strong guys pulling it apart, couldn't do it. They, in fact, in the end, attached them to some army vehicles, tanks, and tried to pull them apart. And could not do it. Wow. It does work.
That's why we're having trouble.
So I'm going to do it this way. See if it works. Okay. All right. So. Like I said, if it's physics, it doesn't. It's physics. I've proven this is physics. Okay. Basically works. Okay. So friction is holding these things together. Whereas at this big angle, right, I tried to do that when they were just sitting on top of each other. So, of course, it's not all that strong, but I can still do it. So, nano, again, does that same thing. It takes what we think of as a bulk macroscopic thing, and allows a lot more surface area so you can achieve new phenomena. Okay.
Is it friction that holds nanoparticles together?
No, well, it's an analogy. Again, oftentimes what we're really worried about for nano stuff is chemical reactions that occur at a surface. So this is a demonstration of just increasing the surface area. Okay. By the way, this does have an application. People are working on something called gecko glue. You might have heard of it. Geckos can attach to walls. By not being as silly as us and just having, you know, this much surface area. But actually, they have little tiny hairs that grow off, and not just regular hairs, but hairs that branch off into nano-sized hairs, so that they can dramatically increase the surface area of tongues, and then they can stick on the wall. And just like friction, they can pull their hand leg off this way. Friction doesn't keep them from the bed. They don't slide down the wall.
Is it like Velcro?
Kind of like Velcro, kind of like nano Velcro, yeah. 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 Yeah, good. Okay, the last one I'm going to talk about, and I don't have much time here. So the way I'm going to do this is I'm going to talk to you a little bit about something called hydrophobicity and hydrophilicity. And then I'm going to show a demonstration that you're welcome to come up. It's easiest to see if you're around this table, if you'd like to, at the end of the session after we break. So now, those of you who want to get the lunch may just go off. So hydrophobic means water repellent. Or water fearing. Hydrophilic means water loving or water attracting. And it turns out that this phenomenon, water hydrophobic and hydrophilic, shows up a lot in nature. I'll get back to that. All right, so, and we're using it in industry too. There's something called nanograss. And nano gets on everything. So, nanograss, which are these little pillars, and if there no electricity is applied to the sample, the pillars actually lay down. And water will wet the surface. They're hydrophilic. They're water attracting. Water will just wet the surface. This is like a water drop on something that likes water goes like that. By applying a small voltage, you can make the water bead up into this ball. And well, that's fun. They've even made it roll uphill by just applying a voltage that sort of ramps up. And, okay, that's cool. You can make water roll uphill. The interesting thing about this is that you can actually now consider making things like labs on a chip, which you may have heard of. There are already some of them. But basically the idea is you go to the doctor and they take a vial of your blood, a big amount of your blood, right? And then they send it off to the lab. You wait a few days to get the results back. Well, a lab on a chip idea is you take a tiny pinprick of blood and you send it through these tiny channels on a little chip where everything that they do at the lab is done on the micro scale on this chip. And so all the reagents mixing, all the analysis, and you get the result back in 5 or 10 minutes while you're at the doctor's office. So people are working on this a lot. And how you flow liquids in a controlled fashion through these labs on a chip is a big problem. Liquids don't like to flow through small channels in a controlled fashion. So if you can control the wettability of the surface in a very simple way, then that enables that kind of technology. So make pumps for these kinds of things. In life, we see that proteins are actually chains of something called amino acids, and amino acids are either hydrophobic or hydrophilic, or something in between. And the way that the protein folds up is primarily governed by trying to shield the hydrophobic parts inside, away from the water. How you get from something like this to something like this is actually, I can say it, but to actually figure it out a priori is actually something that we cannot do yet. The world's largest supercomputers are working on this problem. In fact, they're even trying to employ the best supercomputers that we have, people's brains. There you can download a game called Fold It, and they farm out problems about how to best shape a protein to get it to have the least amount of energy, partly due to hydrophobic and hydrophilic interactions. And so you can download it and help science. So. And the last thing I'll say before I invite you guys to leave or come up is that you'll see it in nature, too. And if you look at leaves, this is a lotus leaf, they tend to be hydrophobic, or even feathers. And that's because plants and animals desperately need to be able to regulate the where the water is getting in and how much water gets in. And if you're a bird in early spring or late fall, you don't want to be wet, but you do want to be clean. And same thing with leaves. You don't want all the water going in here, you want it going down to the roots. And you want to keep the surfaces clean. And so hydrophobic surfaces tend to be self-cleaning, which is why you can get these khaki pants that are nano technology that are spill-resistant and stain-resistant. They're hydrophobic. They just repel water. I have up here a few pieces of material that I use in my work. I make nanoscale thin films that take silicon, which when clean is hydrophilic, and make it hydrophobic. And this, for a variety of reasons, to do with how to get proteins to stick to the film, to the surface. But this is a one molecule thick film. Okay, so tiny amount of material. In fact, I've got it written down here. You'd have to take this piece of silicone and somehow scrape off 3 million of these to get enough material to make up 1 gram, again, the weight of a dollar bill. So this is a tiny amount of material. So, and nature does this too. A lot of the hydrophobic materials that you run into in nature are nanoscale thin layers of a certain kind of chemical, or nanoscale features, or even sometimes microscale features that give rise to hydrophobicity. So I invite you to come up and see this. I think it's kind of cool to see. I can make silicon float just by putting a one molecule thick film on the silicon. Again, as long as the physics works. So, thank you very much. For